Welcome to the Deep Dive Podcast. Our goal is to help you cultivate a regular practice of spending time in God's Word. We take a deeper look at the passages we are reading each week in order to help you encounter the life-changing love of God in Scripture. This podcast is a companion to our weekly reading plan. Check out the podcast description for a link to that. And thanks for joining us. Let's dive in. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Deep Dive Podcast. The Deep Dive Podcast, as you know, is designed for to just really empower you to engage with the Word of God on a regular basis. And so each week we talk about a passage of Scripture that we're reading through together, and we kind of get some background information on that Scripture so that as you dig into that passage over the course of the week and you engage with it, you've got some information, some context that you can use to try to help you understand what God might be saying to you through that passage. And this week, so I'm super excited because we're about to begin reading the book of Hebrews, and there is so much rich theology in the book of Hebrews. It's a really great book, but it's not the easiest book to understand like on its face. And so so this week we're going to do like an introduction episode. We're going to give you some kind of background information about Hebrews that you can kind of keep in your heart and in your mind as you're reading through the book. And so that way it might help you as you're kind of grappling with some of these passages and help you kind of understand what might be going on here. So I have invited, as you know, each week on the Deep Dive Podcast, we have super intelligent, fascinating, brilliant people on the podcast who just sit with me and just kind of talk with me through these passages of Scripture and help me understand them and help you understand them. This week's no exception. I have Dr. Michael Dane with me. Dr. Dane is a professor of Christian studies at Wayland Baptist University here in Lubbock, and he's also the director of the Christian Studies program at the Lubbock campus. And so I'm really grateful to have him with me. Dr. Dane, introduce yourself to everybody. Tell everybody what they need to know about you.
Well, thanks, Brad, and thanks for having me on. As you said, I'm Dr. Michael Dane, and I've been at Wayland since 2009. I earned my PhD at Southwestern Seminary in ethics and theology and church history. And so I was a part-time teacher at Dallas Baptist University for about 7 years before I came to Wayland. Wayland was basically coming home for us. My wife had gone to Tech, and we lived here in the late early 90s and moved to Fort Worth in 1991. We have two children. My son is Seth. He's an electrician.
All right.
And our daughter is Jordan, and she just moved to the Metroplex, and she's working in a bank, and that's what her degree was at, Tech, and in business finance, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so we're enjoying our, well, you know, we're just being empty nest kind of thing right now in that sense, I guess.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's the way it goes.
I'm creeping up on that myself. So my oldest daughter just got married this summer, and then my youngest daughter just started her sophomore year. And so believe me, I am keenly aware that I don't have a whole lot of days
exactly.
left with.
Yeah, I understand.
Yep. So with daughters right around the house.
So like I say, I've been teaching at Wayland since 2009. I pretty much teach whatever. I get to make the schedule, so I get to choose the classes. And, of course, we teach online as well.
Sure.
And so that's always an exciting time. So I guess I'm also – I've been an interim pastor a lot. I've been the interim pastor the last 14, 15 months at McKenzie Terrace Baptist Church, which is on the northeast side of Lubbock, and I've greatly enjoyed that. And I was the interim at Meadow for a while, a couple of times, and some other places. So I get the opportunity to preach around and to do some things that way.
Awesome.
But it's always enjoyable to get to talk about the Bible
and
talk about those historical things. So I'm glad to be with you and excited to be with you in this.
Well, and I think our listeners should know too, like if any of this kind of sparks your imagination or your heart, and you're like, you know what, I'd like to learn a little bit more about the New Testament, or I'd like to learn more about the Pauline epistles or something like that, you know, you should check out the schedule that Wayland Lubbock has. You know, there might be some classes on that you'd be interested in taking. So you can.
We're always glad for a plug for a Wayland.
That's right.
Campus. Absolutely.
That's right.
We have other degrees as well. You can earn a teaching degree. You can earn a business administration degree, or an MBA, or a Master of Arts of Management, and all kinds of courses that we offer. So come see us, and we'll be happy to plug you in someplace.
Sure. Yeah. If you haven't been to the campus, it's a really, really nice campus. And there's a lot of, like I said, there's a lot of class offering options out there. So that'd be a good, anybody looking to continue their education, that would be a great place. And what I really like about the Lubbock campus in particular is that you guys have a lot of class offerings that really fit in the life of people who are professionals. So a lot of
that's what we're set up for. You bet.
Yeah, a lot of night classes, a lot of online classes. So if you're looking to add a degree or something like that, the Wayland Lubbock is a great place for you to check out. So I want to encourage you definitely to do that. So, well, all right, Dr. Dane, the book of Hebrews. So, you know, we were talking before we kind of kicked off the recording here about just kind of, you know, the book of Hebrews is not really the easiest kind of entry level. If you were a brand new Christian or if you're a person who hadn't read the Bible very much, you might not be, Hebrews might not be the recommendation for you to just jump right in with no help or aids or anything like that. It's kind of got some theology in it, and some, you know, allusions to the Old Testament that maybe not everybody would get. So talk a little bit about just the overall character of Hebrews, if you don't mind, and why, you know, why readers might find it a little challenging in places.
Well, one of the kind of the overall pictures of the book of Hebrews has to do with its relationship, or the writer wants to talk about the relationship of Christianity to the Old Covenant.
Yes.
And so in this way, it's almost as if some of the readers perhaps were contemplating going back to the old way of doing things. Mm. And so the writer of Hebrews wants them to know, no, we don't need to go backwards, that Jesus is the answer to this. And so, I mean, I suppose if you want to hear a lot about Jesus, then you would want to read the book of
yes,
Hebrews.
That's right.
Because it certainly talks a lot about Jesus. But it is a bit confusing with all the issues about sacrifice and mm-hmm. and the Old Covenant, New Covenant, things like that. And so it would be a little bit more. And I think the specifics of Hebrews has to do with this broader idea about not going back to the old way of doing things, but persisting on in the way of Christianity and the way of Jesus.
Yeah. I was reading one author earlier, and he was talking about how Hebrews almost might make a really great introduction to the Old Testament, like a text that introduces the Old Testament, because they're especially from the Christian perspective, the author really is trying to take all these things like the temple and the priests, you know, the priestly system and the sacrificial system, trying to take all those things and talk about how Jesus is the kind of the culmination of all that in some way. And so, so it really does pull together a lot of these old covenant themes. So, but you mentioned that it one of the purposes of the book does appear to be that the author's encouraging folks to not return back, not turn away from their Christian faith and turn back to just practicing the Jewish religion and faith at that time. Why do you think that was an issue that this person that felt like he needed to address? Like, what was going on in the lives of the people he was writing to?
Well, you could imagine that if you had a mixed community of folks, maybe people mm-hmm. in your town, or maybe you'd come out of Judaism and become a Christian.
Yeah.
And that people you knew, or we certainly see in the book of Acts that Paul has a lot of conflict with Jewish enclaves of Jewish folks in various towns, and they try to disparage him and do different things. And so you can imagine that somebody who had come out of that might be concerned, or might be, as their neighbors or others from other towns are saying, oh, you don't need all that. That's, you know, that Jesus is not the right way to do this.
Right.
We're good Jews. We know how this is. That the writer of Hebrews, maybe they're facing persecution, and maybe there's pressure, external pressure, to go back. And I think that maybe even at the end, when the writer encourages them not to give up on the assembling together, that may well even be the idea that it was easier not to meet than it was to face the persecution that they were going through.
Yeah, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, because you're really much more of an expert about this than I am. But I think we feel like that Hebrews was written to a group of maybe primarily Jewish believers, or at least people who had a good knowledge of of the Old Covenant, you know, the Jewish scriptures. But probably based in Rome. Don't most scholars kind of think that most of these that it was written to folks who might be in Rome?
Well, it's kind of, I think it's difficult. It could be. I mean, I think that's honestly enough, it may well be even folks back in Palestine or Syria really? Or someplace like that.
Yeah.
The fact that we don't know who wrote it makes it kind of hard to know where it might have been delivered in that case, and maybe even the time in which it was written.
Yeah.
Most of the time, when we think about dates, scholars want to think about, and then the Hebrews would be no exception, of a good round. So, of course, obviously the year 70 is a significant date because that's the date of the destruction of the Jewish temple.
Mm-hmm.
And so New Testament books, scholars want to know, does the writer seem to imagine that the temple is there or is it gone away?
Right.
And if it's there, then the book is written for the year 70. And if the writer seems to think, or at least to hint at the idea that the temple is gone, then it may be after the year 70.
Yeah.
And so you could imagine this being maybe either way, honestly enough, or maybe even on that cusp of things when the Romans have invaded Palestine specifically and are attacking the temple. And so maybe this is a way to say, don't worry about it. If the temple goes away, we have Jesus in that sense.
Yeah.
The
folks who kind of argue for an earlier date, because I think most people would say that it was written before AD like 96, but 97, 96, somewhere in there. They think it may be written before that, but almost you know, people who argue for a date in the 60s, well, there's a couple of passages in Hebrews that they would want to pull out, and they would be like, man, it really feels like here, you know, the writer of Hebrews would have mentioned that the temple had been destroyed if he'd known about it. You know what I mean? And,
sure.
And there's one part where he's, you know, one section where he's talking about, you know, the sacrifices. And that's why, I mean, why do people still make sacrifices if this is, you know, if that's true? And of course, they weren't making sacrifices in the temple. So some people who argue for the earlier date say that, but there certainly is a sense in this where the author of Hebrews is really trying to talk about, the temple as culminating in the person of Jesus, and so to take kind of that infinite emphasis of worship off the actual temple. So, so yeah, you could go kind of either way, either way on that. So you talked about we don't know the author. Can we talk about that a little bit? Because I know you know throughout history, some people have wanted to argue for Pauline authorship, but and certainly some of the early church fathers thought that Paul wrote the letter to the Hebrews. But most scholars today don't believe that. So can we just talk about like what the issues are around authorship?
Sure. Well, I think first of all, we should assert that the fact that we don't know who the author is doesn't minimize the authority of this book in the canon.
Exactly.
Of the Bible.
Yeah.
Right. And so a couple of things I think, and I was just reading the other day about this, that some folks think that at least from the earliest times in which Paul's letters were collected together, you know, we see about in 2 Peter where the writer there seems to talk about Paul's letters.
Yes. Yeah.
So that Paul's letters were collected together for a very long time, early on in the process of their being collected. And it seems to be that sometimes in a lot of places, the book of Hebrews was connected to them, was attached to them as a sort of a smaller canon, as you might say. And so that may be how Paul got associated with this. It certainly doesn't, the theology of Hebrews doesn't at all contradict what Paul talks about at all. Although you might argue that it has a different audience than Paul. Paul is specifically, I think it's after a certain amount of time, focused in on the Gentile question.
Right.
And so the churches to where he wrote were Gentiles. And so the issues are Gentile issues about how to bring the message of Jesus to the Gentile world.
Right.
And Paul deals with different kinds of things. And so if you want to know what Paul thinks about those issues, just read Galatians. I mean, I think that's the main book where you see where Paul's coming from with this relationship to the Jewish world.
Right.
And so in that case, then, the fact that we don't know, and there have been speculations over the years,
sure,
the fact that it wasn't Paul, the language is a lot different. The structure, the way that Paul, that he's writing, of course, this is not an occasional letter. This is probably a homily, honestly, maybe a sermon. And so in that case, then it would look different because it's a different structure, a different style.
Yeah. I want to circle back to something you just said, though, Dr. Dane. I'm sorry, because you said that this is maybe not so much a letter as it is a homily or a sermon in letter form. And I think
you could imagine that this would be the format. I mean, we shouldn't be surprised that preachers are publishing their sermons in the first, second century. I mean, you know, not that they're trying to make a buck or anything, but just that it would, you know, in the sense that this would have been delivered as a sermon, or certainly as an address, perhaps,
yes,
or a homily, and this got transcribed, or however he produced it. Right. Letter writing in the ancient world is interesting in that sense. There's also a whole other level of just the production of literature in general that goes into the Greek context about how the authors had control over their own writings and things like that. And then sometimes they got away from them.
Yeah.
Sometimes people took the letters or the things that that somebody had written and they rewrote it and published it and against the author's knowledge in
right.
that sense. Not that we're thinking that Hebrews is that way, but you could imagine. And so authorship issues too, kind of, I think, impinge on this a little bit.
Sure.
It was probably beginning in like the 16th century with Martin Luther that Luther began to advocate that Apollos,
yes,
so that we see in the book of Acts, might have been the author of this letter. And that's certainly possible. You could even make a case, I suppose, and I don't know, in which maybe Priscilla and Aquila were the authors of this book.
Yeah.
You know, they were the ones that talked to Apollos. And so you could imagine that maybe they were the ones who perhaps that wrote this. We don't know that.
Sure.
I tell my students all the time, I hope that one of these days they're going to be excavating some building over there in the Middle East, and they're going to find a, you know, a big barrel or a bucket, and they're going to find a pot, and inside it they're going to pull out a scroll, and it's going to say, so-and-so wrote the book of Hebrews.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be great? Then we'd know.
Yeah.
But ultimately, again, like we said, it's the authority of that book is not affected by the fact that we don't know who wrote it.
Right.
In that sense.
And the important thing for, you know, for our listeners who are going to be reading the book of Hebrews over the course of the next several weeks, the important thing for you guys out there is to know that Hebrews is a little different from a lot of the other books in the New Testament, particularly where it falls, because it is much more of a sermon. It is much more of a homily than it is a letter. And so it's not that it doesn't have some of the same kind of hallmarks of letters, and its intent is a little different. And I think you'll see that as you're reading. But it's good for you to kind of have that, you know, in the back of your mind. If you could imagine Hebrews being spoken, being preached to a group of people, it kind of helps you understand the imagery and everything that's being used. I think as a pastor, as a speaker, you know, as a speaker, when I'm reading Hebrews, that's what I'm thinking. It's just alive with all this imagery, and there's a cadence to some of it that really feels, you know, like it's being spoken. And so I think that's a good thing to remember as we're getting into it, and who the particular author is not nearly that important. But if you had a really great preacher, you know, in the first century, right? If somebody might be like, you know what, we should record some of what this guy's saying and circulate it around. And if it was a guy like Apollos, right, who was by all accounts a really great speaker and had spent a lot of time being trained by Priscilla and Aquila, and also was familiar with Paul, you know, you could see how a person might arrive at that conclusion. Why Martin Luther might get to that conclusion.
Well, and also Apollos had the background in the Jewish culture.
Yes,
the others, Priscilla and Aquila, obviously did.
Yeah,
and so now recently, there have been some people who tried to make a case that Luke wrote this book, and
yes,
I don't know. I've not actually read the commentary on that, but I know there is a commentary that takes the idea that Luke wrote this book, and I haven't read that. I'm not sure. I've not studied that specifically, but anyway, there are lots of options out there about who might have been the author.
And the important thing, once again, for our listeners is for them to know that this book is very different in a lot of ways from the letters that Paul wrote, that, you know, like you mentioned Galatians, you know, Corinthians, 1st, 2nd Corinthians, Philippians, you know, some of the books that Paul wrote. It's very different in a lot of ways from those books, but there are also some striking similarities to it too. So you can kind of see how there's some connection between the two, and definitely some familiarity with the writer of Hebrews and Paul's theology, thought, and maybe even his letters.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So that's a good thing for everybody to kind of think about as you're reading this. So let's talk a little bit, if we can, maybe we've addressed a little bit maybe some of the purposes for writing Hebrews, You mentioned it's kind of to encourage people, maybe to encourage them in their faith. Yes. You mentioned probably the audience may have been people who were experiencing, had just experienced, or were in the midst of experiencing some kind of persecution, which was, you know, especially if you're putting this, you know, like after about 50 AD, there's plenty of that going around in different quarters of the Roman world. But there it seems like that one of the main purposes is just to really encourage people who were kind of experiencing some difficult times to just persist in their faith and to keep their eye on the prize, so
to
speak.
Absolutely. Yes, definitely. In fact, you can even see at the end of this that in some ways, the last couple of chapters, chapter 11, especially, that we could even make a case that Jesus as the originator of the new covenant, means and requires faith, even though we have to wait for the promises to be fulfilled, and then endurance for the sake of the gospel.
Right.
And then finally, obedience. So the one author has said faith, endurance, obedience. That's sort of the culmination of all of this. These are the three main things that the author says as he draws it all to a close about, we've been talking about all this, and these are what you need to focus on, major on: faith, obedience, endurance. And so those are certainly good emphases that book definitely promotes.
Yeah. And ones that we need to be reminded of even today.
Absolutely.
You know, many of us, are facing, you know, difficult, painful circumstances, and we need faith, obedience, and endurance in the midst of that. So in that way, Hebrews is encouraging. Is encouraging in a lot of ways for us today. So let's if you don't mind, let's talk about just briefly maybe some of the weird things that are that are in the book of Hebrews, just to kind of give our folks a primer on it. But let's start with, there's a whole, I mean, the very first of the book is a whole long conversation about angels in there. And so, could you maybe give us a little bit of thought or background on why that's being talked about and why the author of Hebrews is wanting to address that so strongly here at the first letter?
It could be, I think, and maybe it's the beginning point of his conversation about, in fact, I think the prologue, you call it, chapter one, first four verses, obviously emphasizes that there's a difference. Things have changed.
Yes.
In the past, he says, God spoke to his people through the prophets, and now that's changed. We don't need the prophets anymore. We don't need these other mediators of God's word. So things have changed. It used to be, if you look back, we see that there were other heavenly mediators. The angels came and gave God's word to people. Even in the book of Genesis, we see that representatives of God came and gave a message to Abraham and other things. And so you see in some ways that they're the ones who have announced the message to the people. And then you see then later on that changes to Moses. Moses becomes the spokesman for God. And then eventually, well, and for the Hebrew people, it becomes the word. And so the text itself, the Torah, becomes the word of God. So in this case, then, I think the writer wants to start out by saying, Jesus is the one. He's the new mediator. He's the one who is the final representation of who God is.
Yeah.
And so now we don't need to go back. We don't. And so the superiority starts with angels, to which the angels ever say, you are my son, today I've become your father.
Yeah.
And so, well, none of them. And in that case, the writer now is picking up on a theme. In fact, you probably, we should encourage people, if they're going to read Hebrews, that they should start out by reading Psalm 110.
Oh, there you go.
Because some folks think that this book is an exposition of Psalm 110.
Yes.
And so some of the very same themes come up. Psalm 110 is quoted in all the sections of this book. So you know, start with Psalm 110 and see what the writer says there, the psalmist has to say about who God is in that case. And so in this case, then, the writer's saying Jesus is superior to angels, other heavenly, other divine beings.
Right, yeah.
Right. And then he can go on and talk about that Jesus is superior to the leaders that were in the Exodus, Moses and Joshua and all these others.
Right.
And then finally, he begins in chapter 7 by talking specifically about this Levitical priesthood by saying that Jesus is superior to the Levitical priests as well because of his perfect sacrifice.
Yeah.
And so all of these ways, I think, are a way to say that Jesus now is the superior mediator of this new covenant that we've promised you that came about, yes, by Jesus' death and resurrection. But that new covenant is what we're focusing on now, and not the old covenant. And so all these other ways in which God has spoke to people, we don't need that anymore. We have Jesus.
That's right. He's the fulfillment of all of that. He's the culmination of all of it. Yeah, that's good. Yep. So that brings me, you talked about how the author points out that Jesus is the, you know, is the fulfillment of the Levitical priesthood as well, superior to all of that. And so, and he uses this obscure, really obscure, I mean, we just have a couple of sentences in Genesis about Melchizedek, you know, a brief, brief story. So, so what do our folks need to know about Melchizedek when they get to that point? And we'll dig into it obviously a lot deeper when we get to that section, but why would the, why would he bring up Melchizedek? What is that about?
A couple of things. First of all, if you read Genesis 14, that's the story where Melchizedek shows up. Mm-hmm. Abraham has just had this great battle. He's defended Lot against all these kings.
Yeah.
And then this fellow comes up, this king, Melchizedek, is the king of Salem.
Yeah.
And the writer of Genesis has this this story about Melchizedek not having any origins in some sense, that we don't know about his parentage and all this.
Right.
And so there's a sense in which Melchizedek becomes a type. In typology, this idea about being a type, that Melchizedek becomes a type of this priesthood that the writer of Hebrews wants to talk about, because he has no origin. He's only he only is answerable to God, I guess you might say.
Yeah, right.
That's, so that's why he would want to say. And guess where else Melchizedek shows up? Psalm 110.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, exactly. And so if he's writing about, he knows Psalm 110, he knows Genesis 14, then Melchizedek becomes this figure that represents a person accountable only to God and is a worthy of worship. Because if you see in the Genesis story, Abraham offers a tithe to Melchizedek.
Right.
And so there's a sense in which this guy becomes, Melchizedek becomes sort of a type of, I guess you could say later on, or I guess the writer of Hebrews wants to say, look, here's this guy already who was a king, who's outside of this and is worshiped. Well, Jesus is the same way.
Yeah, yeah.
A king who's worshipped, and so we owe him all of this. And so Melchizedek becomes sort of a type, a representative of what Jesus was later to become. So that's part of what's going on. The writer does, and typology is one of those things we're a little bit foreign to. We don't really get into that a lot. There's other places in which the writer uses typology, particularly when he's talking about the old new sanctuary.
Yes.
That comes up in chapter 9. And so the sanctuary that Jesus came through, a perfect sanctuary, not made by human hands.
Yeah.
And so it's like the one in heaven, but different and all that kind of thing. So typology is a little bit tough to kind of put our finger on exactly. But that's what's going on with Melchizedek, I think, in that sense. That he becomes a type or a representative of what it's like to be a king under God, serving only God, and worthy to be worshipped in that sense.
Yeah, Abraham brings a tithe from the you know the proceeds of battle, you know, whatever he brings this tithe to Melchizedek, which is something that a person would do. They would bring a tithe to a priest, to a you know, to an emissary of one of the gods. So for Abraham to bring this tithe to Melchizedek, it's almost like this acknowledgement that he understands Melchizedek to be some kind of a servant of God, some kind of, so there's a priestly function. That's why he can receive the tithe, but he was a priest before there were priests, before any priests had been ordained.
Exactly.
You know, you could see the writer of Hebrews saying, so that's why Jesus is superior. He comes from that order of Melchizedek. Remember that guy?
Right.
You know,
right.
So that's good. That's really good stuff. I think that'll help, you know, folks, because, you know, when you're just kind of blowing through this, boy, it's really, really helpful that you pointed out to that, because we talked about Hebrews as a sermon or a homily, but specifically maybe even a sermon or a homily on Psalm 110. Like that's super helpful because you know it is quoted.
Preachers, honestly enough, preachers sometimes use illustrations they think everybody understands.
Yeah.
And they don't, you know what I'm saying? Because I've used stories in preaching, and you think, man, this is great.
Yeah.
And you let it out there, and people are like scratching their heads.
What is that?
I don't get it. I don't understand. And so maybe some folks scratched their heads about Melchizedek and said, what is this guy
talking about?
Yeah. But so it could be. I don't know.
If it was in the context of a discussion that he was, you know, or a sermon that he was delivering on Psalm 110, and everybody knew he was delivering,
right.
Which also Psalm 110 is a passage that lots of Jewish people would have memorized. I mean, mean, they would have known it,
sure.
You know?
So, yes, absolutely.
So whenever he's referencing all of that for the original hearers, they're like, oh yeah, I know exactly what's going on.
Right.
You know,
right. They know the context where we don't.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah. So, their brains are firing. Yeah. That's, I remember that passage. So, but anyway, that is really, really helpful information. So this week, before we start the weekly reading, your job this week, good listeners, is to just read Psalm 110 and keep that rolling around in the back of your mind as we kind of launch out into the book. Man, that's really that is really helpful stuff, Dr. Dane. That's really good.
Well, so, I'm happy to do it.
So talk
don't
to
let
me.
A bunch of Bible geeks talk about the Bible because they get carried away.
So. Oh my gosh, yeah. I tell people all the time, like, you know, since we started this podcast, you know, this is one podcast I don't ever have trouble getting people to do this with me because I talk to a lot of pastors, you know, and other people in ministry to do this podcast. And all of them are like, let's see, I get to sit around and talk for an hour about the Bible with my friend. Yes. I think
yes,
I want to do
absolutely.
That. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
So, but anyway, so let's talk a little bit about maybe some of the major themes, that we see in the book of Hebrews. You kind of mentioned a general outline maybe of the book of Hebrews that you
right.
had.
Sure.
Let's talk through some of that stuff just so people can kind of start to get a, if it is a sermon or if it is a homily, sermons in the ancient world, not that different from sermons today in the sense that they were structured arguments. There was definitely, and this one, whoever the author of Hebrews is also a person who it feels like is pretty familiar with like Greek rhetorical method and stuff like that.
Absolutely.
Because there's
yes.
definitely a structure to the argument he's making. So, so talk to us a little bit about what that looks like and what we need to keep in the back of our mind about the structure of this sermon.
Well, there are a lot of ways to divide it up. I know, and you can find different books to talk about the outline of the book or whatever.
Sure.
I think it helps. Some of the ones I've looked at recently, let's say, it talks about the prologue. Obviously, that's that first four verses, which asserts that Jesus is the exact representation. That word in there is this word icon, or this word which represents almost as if you would say a kingly signet ring. Yeah. Represents the king.
Right.
So whatever that ring stamps on, that's who Jesus is for God. So
yeah.
If you want to know what God's like, just look at Jesus. That's
yeah.
what the writer of Hebrews says. And then he begins with this superiority. The sovereign son is the superior mediator. So if we're thinking about needing a mediator, and we talked a little bit before about the idea that all along, the Jewish people have had mediators between themselves and God.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it were these divine beings that they encountered. Maybe it was Moses, the Levitical leaders, or the Exodus leaders. And then we saw the text, and then the priesthood. So
yeah.
now the writer says, okay, we're going to start out by saying Jesus is the one.
Yeah.
He's the top of the heap of all of this. He is the top. He's the top of the hierarchy of all of this. And so he's, first of all, superior to the angels. We talked about maybe, their nature is mediators. He's superior to the leaders of the Exodus, Moses and Joshua. As great as they weren't as good as Jesus,
mm-hmm.
right? And then he talks about the superiority of Jesus over these Levitical priests,
mm-hmm.
even though they were the ones who mediated through the sacrifices and all that. Now, Jesus is the one, though, that is superior to them, because he is the exact representation of God the Father.
Right.
So that's the first section, I guess you'd say, part one.
Uh-huh.
Probably goes from like chapter one through chapter seven, the end of chapter seven.
Yeah.
So that'd be the first main section. So when you read through those chapters, keep in mind that's what the writer's trying to do. He's emphasizing that all of these previous mediators, as good as they were and as important as they were in their time, have been, in this case then, fulfilled, I guess, is the word you used earlier, in Jesus.
Yeah.
And so Jesus is the one now. Why would we ever go back to something that was lesser
right.
when we can have the top, when we can have the one who's the best?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Best representation, the most full representation of who God is. And so that's the first section, I guess you'd say, if you're breaking it up as a in an outline. And then, I guess, in the second part, he now wants to talk about the new covenant. So beginning like in chapter 8 through chapter 10, he's going to talk about the new covenant. And I mean, you don't have to look far back in the, you know, even the book of Jeremiah, right, has the new covenant and this whole
yeah.
idea about the new covenant. And so the whole notion of a New Testament implies that there is a new covenant.
Right.
And what does this new covenant look like? And so some of this, I think one of the things that's helpful too, is that writer of Hebrews doesn't disconnect the new covenant from the old covenant.
Right.
He demonstrates how they're the fulfillment, as you, the word you used before, or that they're still connected. That the new covenant is the fulfillment of the promises that God had made all those years ago.
Yeah.
That's a fulfillment. So he's going to explain what this looks like. Jesus is a priest, as a high priest. All of these ways in which Jesus goes through this new sanctuary and the new covenant and the new sacrifices. If they're thinking about maybe, and if it is that the temple is going away, then maybe the writer of Hebrews wants them to know, don't worry about it.
Right.
Because Jesus is the one who's fulfilled these covenant responsibilities in his own sacrifice.
Yeah.
Because he talks about Jesus being sacrificed outside the city and,
yeah,
and that all these things. And so they all point back to saying it's fulfilled. It's done. Jesus has done what we needed in this sacrificial system.
Yeah.
And so if we don't have the temple, that's okay. We
right.
don't need that
yeah.
because we have Jesus.
Yeah.
And it's never wrong to think about this. And certainly the New Testament testifies the fact that if you got Jesus, that's what you need.
Right. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's right.
I tell my students, my Sunday, the folks that I deal with in church all the time, if your Sunday school teacher asks you a question and you don't know the answer, just say Jesus.
Jesus. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Because he's the standard Sunday school answer.
That's right.
Now, it may not work on a test at Wayland.
Yeah,
it
no.
It will work in Sunday school, right? Yeah. So Jesus is the answer to all of this.
If
so the writer of Hebrews emphasizes that.
Yeah,
so,
if you absolutely. Say Jesus in Sunday school as an answer to a question, and that's not the right answer, the teacher's asking the wrong question.
The teacher's asked the wrong question, exactly.
So that takes us through, did that take us through?
That's through like the end of chapter 10 maybe, or at least. Yeah. Now, all along too, the writer has done these explanations, you might say. So
right.
the writer has some sort of theological explanation, but along with that is always this thing that fancy New Testament scholars called a paranesis. So uh-huh. if they're studying along and they see this word paranesis, that basically means that's a statement or some sort of a composition that's meant to warn, to encourage, or to urge people to take the right course of action. So
right.
a lot of the book of Hebrews is actually very practical
mm-hmm.
because it encourages them, based on what he's just told them, to do that, to perform the actions that he's encouraging them to do.
Yeah.
Here's what we're telling you is the truth. Now, based on that, you need to act this way based
right.
on what you've learned and what we've just talked about.
Yeah.
And so all along, there's this flow back and forth between explanation and exhortation or encouragement to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And that takes us kind of really through the end of this chapter 10. And then chapter 11 is that great roll call of the faithful.
Right.
And in that case, then, if you're looking at a movement in this, so you've moved from the old way of doing things, old mediators, old way of doing things, to now Jesus' new covenant administration,
uh-huh.
right? And now the new covenant then has ethical requirements.
Yes.
There are responsibilities on the other end of all this that we fulfill because we're followers and we're a part of the new covenant. And our commitment then, again, comes back beginning in chapter 11. Think about all the others. In fact, the writer of Hebrews says, these folks were faithful even though they didn't know yet.
Yeah.
They had to look forward to the promises that we have inherited.
Right.
And that we get to experience. And so in that case, then, that's where faith, endurance, and obedience comes in, as he tells them at the end of all of this, that the new covenant requirements, I mean, I guess you could imagine if he's looking back and thinking, if he read the book of Matthew and he read the Sermon on the Mount, and Jesus says, this is what new covenant people look like.
Right.
Then this is what he's encouraging them. Be faithful, have endurance, be obedient. And so these things come at the end as a strong encouragement for them to live this kind of faithful lifestyle on the other end of all this, because we have inherited the new covenant and we're a part of that. So, I mean, there's these discrete pieces sort of give a flow to the end of it. And so the writer then at the end of all this is kind of drawing it all up pretty tight.
Yeah.
Do these things because you're a part of the new covenant.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's as he's getting, you know, as he's transitioning there in chapter 11, the centrality of faith, you know, to all of it, because he's talked about all of these, you know, the old system, sacrificial system, the, you know, everything else. And then he's talking about, but look, this is all centers around faith. It's all about faith. And here's the examples of faith that you can see, even these people that you revere from our past, from our shared past, even these people you revere, what really marked them out was faith. That's really what sets them apart. Right. And that's the characteristic. So that's what we want to have too, is faith. So when we have faith in Messiah, right, then here's what that looks like. You know, here's how that is lived out.
But see, there's the double-edged piece of that idea about faith, because faith is, yes, knowledge about who Jesus is and knowledge of the new covenant.
Sure.
But it's also faithfulness.
Yes, exactly.
Which means that on our part of it, that we walk in faithfulness.
Yes.
To honor what Jesus has done in that case then. So it's not just, you can't just say, oh yeah, I have faith. And James says, oh yeah, great. That's great. Show me your faith by what you do.
That's right. That's
so the writer of Hebrews is saying, this faithfulness is the way that we walk. It's a way of living. And so the people today need to hear that,
yeah.
You know, that our walk with Jesus is based in our understanding of who he is. Yes. But it's also empowered through the Spirit of God,
right,
to be faithful and to walk faithfully. Uh-huh. To represent, you know, it's like, I guess sports analogies don't always work real well, but in some sense, if you're a Tech fan, you don't go wearing orange, burnt orange. You know, you get a lot of big trouble out in West Texas
it
wearing burnt orange.
Burns your skin. Yes.
Yes, exactly. And so if you're faithful to Tech, you wear red and black.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so in this case, then, if we're faithful to Jesus, then there are ethical implications about how we live.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought this up, because, you know, I think it's difficult maybe for us in the, you know, in the 21st century. Is it? Are we 21st? Yeah, 21st century. It's difficult for us in the 21st century to think about, well, so I like to talk to people about this. So, you know, when the Greeks talked about knowledge, they kind of separated it out. You know, Greek philosophers separated out different kinds of knowledge. You know, so there was this one kind of knowledge that was based on, understanding all of the forces that were at work underneath our reality. You know, and so you got that knowledge, right? You figured out that kind of knowledge by learning, right? But it was factual based knowledge, and that was the highest.
That's what they called physics, exactly.
Yeah, that's the highest form of knowledge for them. That was the highest form of knowledge.
Right.
So somewhere below that was was what we would, what they, ethics, praxis, there was lived knowledge. There was a knowledge about, and it was about being, so it's more than just how we act, but it's who we are, and how we live in the world, how we live and interact in the world.
Absolutely.
So that knowledge is arrived at by praxis, right? By practicing things, But that was different. The Greeks did that differently. Like a lot of folks in the ancient world didn't make that kind of distinction. And certainly, you know, people in Palestine and even in the East didn't see the highest form of knowledge as this kind of theoretical understanding of the way the world worked. They kind of understood all of it as kind of the same big ball of wax, and it culminated in who we are, or in what the Greeks might have called ethics, but it culminated in, you know, this understanding of how we live our lives or who we are. And I think our kind of understanding of wisdom or knowledge is kind of based on this, because we're in the Western world, it's based on this Greek understanding. And so when we think of faith, for example, the word faith, the way that you just described it, we think of faith as, unbelievably, as some kind of like an intellectual exercise, like that by we understand something and then we agree with it, and we think of that as faith. But the way you described it, I think, is way more profound and way and it's a distinction that probably the person who's writing Hebrews is not even thinking about, because his readers don't process things that way.
Right. Well, and I think there's a reason why in the book of Acts, the believers in Jesus are called followers of the way.
Of the way, that's right.
Yes, because that's the way in which they live. That's the way they follow.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way they walk. That's their whole life.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, it's better. I've tried a lot more to think about, and of course, I teach ethics a lot of times, and in terms of that, it's about walking. It's about a way of life. And it's about the not just we think about all the intricate decisions we make each day, but that in some ways, if we have a starting point in Jesus, there are a lot of decisions that we don't have to make. We've already made them because that's the way Jesus people live.
Yeah.
And so we're not going to, those are things that are not even options to us because they're not the way Jesus people would live.
That's right.
And so it actually makes things a lot easier. To walk in the way is because we know here's the way that, and read the Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah.
Read the book of James. These are the ways that Jesus people live. And I think the writer of Hebrews has got the very same idea of how this works. These are the ways in which things work out. This is the way that we are. It becomes who we are and not some sort of a, esoteric, like you said, aspiration to knowledge.
Yeah.
But that it's the way we are. It becomes who we are as persons. And then it just flows out in the way that we live.
Yeah, I describe to people sometimes, that in the Israel of Jesus' time, right? Every Jewish male memorized the Torah. They memorized the entire first five books of the Old Testament. That's what they all did. By the time they were 13, right, or bar mitzvah or whatever, 13 years old, they could memorize the whole Torah. But then a rabbi would pick 12 of them. 12 of the smartest, 12 of the brightest. And he would take those, he would select those as his disciples, and those people would walk around with him. And he would show them, okay, now you know Torah, like in your head. I'm going to show you how to live Torah, right? Now that you know Torah, the next step, the next evolution is to live Torah. And so the highest form of knowledge was this lived being knowledge. It's not meant to just be housed in your brain or understood, right? It was meant to be actually lived out. And that's what Jesus did. Only he picked, also rants, but he picked these people, which I'm grateful for because that I could be in that number, but he picks them. He shows them how to live Torah and then teaches them to do the same thing. Tell people how to live this thing out.
Right.
And we don't, in modern, Christianity in the Western world, because we don't understand knowledge that way, we sometimes have struggled with that. I think it's why people were, had all kinds of questions about James. Like James had no, there was no question for him. The two things were the same thing. Faithfulness and works were they were two sides of the same coin, and he didn't even understand a difference there. So anyway, for those of you too who are listening, any of you who've watched The Mandalorian, you should know this is exactly what we're talking about, right? This is the way. That's what they say over and over again, right? And that, they say it's because the clothes they wear, the things that they choose to do, every decision that they make, they're like, look, this is the way. And for those of us who are Christians, there's just a sense in which all of this is all of this truth that we believe about Jesus is supposed to express itself in our being and in our action. And to the point that we're just like, look, this is the way,
Exactly. So there's an old story about two rabbis. There were two prominent rabbis in the first, second century among the later rabbinic Jews, Rabbi Shammai and Rabbi Hillel.
Yeah.
Some guy one day went to Rabbi Shammai and said, Rabbi, teach me to do the Torah and teach me to do it standing on one foot. To which Shammai said, go away. You're an idiot.
Yeah.
All right. So he went to Hillel, and he said, Rabbi Hillel, teach me to do the Torah, and teach me to do it standing on one foot. To which Hillel said, supposedly, whatever is hateful to your neighbor, do not do. That's the sum of Torah. The rest is praxis.
Right.
The rest is practice. Go and do.
Yeah.
And so Jesus says what? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Right.
Right? So now we have Scott McKnight, who's taken that and made the Jesus Creed. Uh-huh. Which his whole book on the Jesus Creed is love God, love neighbor.
Yep.
And these are the things that Jesus said are the two most important commandments. Love God and love your neighbor.
He said all of the law and the prophets hang on these two things.
Right. There it is right there. If you live that out, that's it. And so the writer of Hebrews is saying, hello, this is what it looks like. This is in our context what it looks like to live out love God, love neighbor.
Yeah.
And we do this because of who Jesus is. And so there's some, doctrinal stuff that talks a lot about the importance of Jesus. And so those were the questions they had. If they're trying to turn back to the old way.
Right.
And the writer of Hebrews says, well, we can't go back there because now we know once Jesus is there, Jesus changes everything.
Yeah.
And the way that we do it. And so the writer of Hebrews has to help them understand how not to abandon Jesus as the mediator of the new covenant.
Yeah, yeah. And, yeah. You know, I think that's important. And this might be a good place to kind of land our conversation. But you know, when we are experiencing really painful and really difficult circumstances, sometimes what happens to people when they're experiencing that is they begin to question their faith. And sometimes people who are going through really painful, really difficult circumstances for one reason or another, that's kind of the point where they start to question the things that they believed. And that's kind of the point where they kind of tend to start drifting away from living in the way.
Right.
Since we were having that conversation, they kind of drift away from living in the way. And which was clearly what the author of Hebrews is trying to encourage these folks not to do. You know, I know you're going through a hard time. And in fact, many of them were going through a really difficult and painful circumstances, maybe even because of their affiliation with the way. And, right. Jewish religion and Jewish, you know, ethnicity was legal in Rome. And so that, you know, transitioning back to maybe the Jewish thing may have felt a little safer for many of them, you
Could
know?
Be.
And so, but he's telling them, look, no, don't do that. Don't go back. Don't go backwards. You know,
right.
Keep your, even though you're going through really difficult, really painful circumstances, you know, look, there's a way to go through this and a way to go through it so that on the other side, you know, all of this faithfulness is realized and rewarded on the other side of it. So
and the other point that kind of connects it here is that it may well be, and I think American Christians face this difficulty, is mm-hmm. that the center of this book is Jesus' death as a sacrifice and burial and resurrection.
That's right.
And so maybe some of the difficulties we have are like, well, you know, if God really loves me, then I wouldn't have to be whatever.
Exactly.
Or I wouldn't have to suffer, or I wouldn't have to. And there's a lot of American Christians, I think, who don't really want to follow a Messiah who was crucified.
Exactly.
They would rather have a Messiah who wins all the time, or one yes. who's, you know, makes them healthy and wealthy and wise and all these things.
Right.
And so, you know, maybe they say to themselves, you know what? This is just too hard to be a Christian. It'd be easier. Being a Christian means I have to do all these ethical things and I have to live this way. That's just too hard.
Yeah.
I don't want to do that. I want to do whatever I want to do. And so, you know, that's just too much trouble to be a Christian. Too
yeah.
hard.
Yeah.
And surely Jesus didn't mean for that to be the case.
Yeah. Surely he wanted for me to be happy and to have all my desires fulfilled. You know, surely
exactly.
that's what he meant. You know,
there's no sacrifice involved in all this. I didn't sign up for that.
That's right. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Right.
And which in some ways would have been, you know, very similar to the world in which, you know, the author of Hebrews is writing. You know, the Romans certainly didn't, you know, they certainly didn't, you know, deify a person who was crucified on a cross. The whole Roman cult was all about, you know, power and authority and victory. And so,
exactly.
so, you know, that's why this whole story of Christianity is so crazy that right. it exploded the way it did. And we still have it now is because it was completely
right.
countercultural at the time. It didn't even
right.
make sense. You know, in a lot of ways, and for us too. Like, it's good for us to just pause and remember what Dr. Dane said, that the very center of Christian faith is the suffering and the death and the burial of Jesus Christ, and then his resurrection on the other side of that. But
absolutely.
But the very center of it is a God who chose to die, a God who chose not to. That's not right. A God who chose to be murdered, to allow himself to be murdered. Like, that's at the very center of what our faith is. And as believers, then it shouldn't surprise us that the very center of what it means for us to live in the Jesus way is self-sacrifice. And any expression
exactly.
of Christianity that does not have at its center self-sacrice is not Christian. It can't be, because it claims a name that it is not similar to
it. Doesn't live up to.
Yeah.
I've seen a cartoon. Maybe you've seen this on Facebook a few times. It has a picture. It's a picture of some of the Marvel superheroes sitting on a cloud.
Yeah.
The Hulk and Spider-Man and some others, and Thor maybe.
Yeah.
And there's Jesus sitting on this cloud with them. And he says, and that's how I saved the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think
I always go back to that. That's a great illustration of how we have things turned upside down.
Yeah.
We want the superheroes to be the ones with the power and the ones who can you know, but Jesus is the one who gave up his life.
That's right.
So that others could have life.
Yeah. Had all of the power in the world, and he used it to heal a few people and to feed a few folks.
Paul talks about in Philippians.
Yeah, exactly. but then allowed himself to be humiliated and murdered. And that statement, that thing, and we don't often get this in our world because it's just become so much a part of the air we breathe. But that statement, the center of our worship is a God who allowed himself to be humiliated and spat upon and just, you know, demeaned in every way. And ultimately murdered, right? That thing is so crazy and so scandalous that it's really difficult for a lot of folks in the world to even get their head around a God that would choose to
Absolutely.
Do that.
Right.
And when you read Philippians chapter 2, what Paul says is, you know, this thing that Jesus did, that humility, that, you know, obedience to the point of death, like that is the essence of Jesus. And it is the essence of who we are to be as believers. And
exactly.
That's shocking. Yep. And frankly, it's a little scary. Dr. Dane, I'm not going to lie to you.
I agree. It is. It's hard to live out.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, but rewarding, we become who we were created to be
right.
when we live
the
in
cross-bearing
that way.
Lifestyle becomes the way in which we live.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right. Keep all those things in your mind, folks. Man, this is a great, Dr. Dane, thank you so much. This is a great, great introduction to the book of Hebrews. You guys have all kinds of things to think about as you read through the book of Hebrews. Go read Psalm 110 right now. Keep that in the back of your mind as you're reading through Hebrews. This discussion is going to be really, really helpful to you as you dig into the book of Hebrews. And I'm so thankful to you, Dr. Dane, for giving us a little bit of your time. Thank you so much
Happy
for joining us.
You bet.
All right.
Glad you invited me.
Well, listen, guys, have fun. Have fun digging in. Have fun reading this week. And as always, keep diving deep. Have a great time digging into God's Word this week. The Deep Dive Podcast is a ministry of First Baptist Church Shallow Water. Check out the description of this episode for a link to the reading plan, our church's website, and more. Remember, God is good, and His Word is true. Keep diving in.